This is, on the other hand. Podcast sponsored by Braver Angels in Arkansas that explores politics and other issues of importance to Arkansans through conversations with community leaders. Stay with us as we talk to another leader in Arkansas who works across differences to get things done and to bring us closer together.
Hello and welcome to On the Other Hand. I'm your host, April Chatham Carpenter, and I'm here today with my co-host, Glenn White. And on our podcast, Glenn and I interview community leaders in Arkansas who help work towards solutions across various political and other divides, or who in other ways reach across various divisions within our community. And Glenn, we have an exciting guest today. So tell us about who we have.
Good morning, April. Good to be here again with you. We are very happy. We're delighted, in fact, to be speaking today with Janet Harris. She is the executive director and CEO of the Rockefeller Institute, which most of you probably know resides up on Pettigene Mountain. Among other things, Janet has a master's degree in public administration from the University of Arkansas at Little Rock. She is currently pursuing her executive certificate in nonprofit leadership from the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. And she's got a little bit of a background in several areas. I know that she has worked with the city of Little Rock. She has served in a senior leadership capacity in three different state executive offices, I believe, including, as I understand it, 8 years as Arkansas Deputy Secretary of State. And then now as the head of former Governor Winthrop Rockefeller's legacy organization, the Rockefeller Institute. We thought she would be a good person to come on and talk with us because, according to the website, the Institute, quote, believes valuing diversity of opinion, practicing collaborative problem solving, and engaging in respectful dialogue combine to create transformational change. That's something they call the Rockefeller ethic, and I'm sure we'll hear more about that shortly. But because that mission and the approach of the Institute is so very consistent with the philosophy and practices of our own group, Braver Angels, here in Arkansas, we thought it'd be good to have Janet on and tell us a little more about the Institute's work and her role. So welcome to On the Other Hand, Janet.
Thank you, Glenn, and thank you, April. It's a pleasure to join you and to be a part of the work that you all do with Braver Angels here in Arkansas and across the country. There is no shortage of a need for people to be able to be in community and conversation in a way that is effective and healing. And so I appreciate what you all do to facilitate that.
Well, yeah, I hear that a lot from people who hear what we do and say, oh, well, we really need that. And so I always appreciate when I see other people with like minds doing the same kind of thing. So on this podcast, Janet, we try to talk with community leaders who in some way work across various types of divisions, usually political, but not necessarily political divisions. We try to find people who we can count on being able to talk with civility to other people who may have different views. And given the similarity of the mission of the Rockefeller Institute with our own approach in Braver Angels, I think you're obviously someone that would be good to share your own thoughts of what's happening at the Institute. So maybe as a background, let's start by you telling us a little bit about what the Institute does, some of its key educational programs. And I understand the Walk with the Governor workshop is a biggie for y'all. So just fill us in on some of those as a starting point.
Sure. Well, we at the Institute, and as you mentioned, Glenn, we're located on top of Pettigene Mountain. We are essentially in occupying the former cattle farm of Winthrop Rockefeller when he moved to Arkansas about 70 years ago. And he built his home here. And yes, he raised cattle, but he also had a conference center here where he called people together on a regular basis, citizens, government leaders, business leaders, subject matter experts, to come to this facility and engage in conversation about how we could make Arkansas a better place. And he did that for 20 years here on the mountain. And so our work today is rooted in the legacy of bringing people to the mountaintop to have discussions about areas of opportunity and challenge in Arkansas. And so we talk about collaborative problem solving and also creating opportunities. So how can we envision our future together? So that's work we do. It's really rooted in the DNA of this place and of Winthrop Rockefeller. We also, as we convene, we aren't simply a conference center. We also provide services and assistance to people who want to come together and work on a common issue. And so what the Institute provides is facilitation and meeting design. So for example, if you know that you have a community issue that you're trying to work through, you have a lot of different voices that need to be heard in a respectful way, we can design facilitate that meeting so that you can raise your own perspective, bring your own perspective to the table, but also hear the perspectives of others and work together for some kind of solution you can all agree on. And so we design and facilitate meetings. We also provide workshops to teach some of our conference guests and groups on how to have difficult conversations. And I will say it's not always about the red-blue divide. We think about that a lot because of how polarized we are in the country, but really differences of opinion span a lot of different perspectives, not just political ideology. So I think having some structure and intentionality and learning about how you can connect with other people across any kind of difference, even if it's just simply we work in different departments in our organization and accounting sees something one way, marketing sees it another. How do we have better conversations with each other to really get to that common ground? So we do that work with a number of groups and with our own programs that we sponsor here at the Institute.
That makes sense. And you're right. There are so many different ways people can divide themselves and struggle with each other. That's kind of our nature as animals, social animals, you know, is that we form groups and sometimes they're in groups, sometimes out groups. So it's good to know then that people throughout Arkansas may have a variety of ways that they could benefit from coming to you guys. And so I encourage them to consider that. Tell us a little bit, if you will, to start off about yourself, a little bit of your background, your early life. What kind of values led you to do what you're doing now? How you got to be where you're at?
Thank you for asking. Stories are always interesting to me for how we all kind of got to this place in our careers, usually by something that influenced us. I grew up on a farm in Northeast Arkansas in Marmaduke, which is in Green. Grew up on a hog farm, played basketball, went to public schools there, and grew up with a fairly tightly knit small town Arkansas community. And then I left to go to college at the University of Central Arkansas, which is where I graduated. And then I just stayed. I still live in Conway after all these years, my new home. But what really influenced, I think, my career in public service, which is predominantly where I've worked throughout my professional lifetime, is my sister. She is 3 years to the day younger than me, and she has Down syndrome. And as I was, sort of her shepherd and escort and protector and defender throughout school, our school years together, and even when I kind of stepped in for my parents to help take care of her, I understood it was my responsibility, to help her, enable her to do the best that she could, right? And so it was really important for me figuring out in my career how I could help people help themselves and be the best version of themselves. And so I've done that through a variety of positions. In a good part of my career was in state government and working to try to connect government to citizens. And so citizens can understand what government institutions are there to do, how they can find help, if not within government institutions and other places in the community. So that idea, that responsibility to enable others to achieve a shared purpose is core to the definition of my leadership, and it's a value I hold dear.
That's interesting. Very good. Yeah, I think you may have something in common with April from what you were saying about your time at UCA, right, April?
Absolutely. And Janet, you know, I think you said you played basketball in high school. You played basketball for UCA as well, didn't you?
I did, yes.
Okay. Yeah, we both are, our alma maters are both UCA. I have student athletes in my current classes at UA Little Rock too. And I think about athletics programs in high school and college. There's so much, you know, commitment to a sport, so many important life lessons and skills that arise from engaging in team sports in particular. And I'm wondering if there were any lessons from those early years with sports that might have helped you in your career also in your current position.
Absolutely. A lot of those examples, I think, and experience. But the things I would highlight is, number one, when you play any kind of team sport, you have to understand where your contribution is, where your strengths are, and where you need someone else to offset your weaknesses. You know, basketball team, not everybody's a great rebounder, not everybody's a great shooter, not everybody's great handling the ball. So you have to rely on the teammates that are there that can do those things well. And you have to encourage them, and they have to have confidence in themselves. And so to me, leading a team is like coaching. It's assembling people with a diverse set of skills and strengths and helping them help one another. You know, and so that concept of teamwork is something that really stuck with me from my time playing sports. I think the other second thing is that, you know, we are not enemies. There's a difference between being a rival and being an enemy. And so when we compete in sports, we love to have a rivalry, don't we? I mean, we love to, you know, cheer for our people and not cheer for the other side. We want to win. And that's okay. That's good. But when the game's over, you shake hands. You admire the talent of the other players that are on the court. You know, I've been watching the NCAA women's basketball tournament and watching Caitlin Clark and Angel Reese last night, you know, give each other a hug. That's what we're talking about. Yes, competition is good. There's a competition for ideas. There's a competition for how we move our country and our communities forward, but we are not enemies. And so how do we treat each other with that kind of respect that we expect athletes really to portray on the court? So that's something that sticks out to me. And then I think the last thing that I always say I learned on the basketball court was just the responsibility that I had for my teammates, especially as captain of the team. When I was in high school, we lost a very heartbreaking game in the state tournament. And I remember sitting in the front of the bus in tears, and I was feeling sorry for myself, you know. And my coach came over, and I'd already signed to play college basketball at the time. And my coach came over and he said, listen, you know, I know this breaks your heart, but you didn't just play your last game tonight. And some of those other girls, now you get up and you go be their captain. And I can't say that I always remember to practice that. Often we all get sunk in our own ruts and our own emotions, but man, is that a leadership lesson. And I try to remember it every day.
And even when we don't win, and I think about this in terms of elections as well, is even when our candidate doesn't win, yep, we can still be neighbors and connect with other people who are on the other side and build up the base who's coming up behind us. So that really illustrates that well. You know, getting back to the work of the Institute, this is so consistent with what you've already been talking about in terms of leadership, but you mentioned earlier design principles that you all actually have when you are facilitating or, you know, groups that might be coming up to the Institute. And I'm curious about what some of those design principles are.
When we are inviting a group here to do collaborative work, there's a couple of assumptions at play. And I think I want to start with those because that's important. One is that they are coming together to work on the something collective, the collective good, for whatever the issue might be. And it could simply be for their organization as a whole, but it might be for the larger community. But that assumption is we want to work together. There is a will to collaborate. Okay. The second assumption is that we're going to have a lot of diverse opinions in the room, and they don't always neatly fall into red and blue, as I said earlier, because when you peel back some of the layers of the onion, whether it's a policy or it's a system issue that we're trying to resolve. It's very nuanced, and your opinions are going to be formed based on your own life experience with that issue. And so we try to start with ground rules. So this assumption is you're coming because you want to work together, number one. And two, you're agreeing to be intentional about this structured conversation that we're going to provide space for you to have. So that's really important. And then I think from there, we are very focused at the Institute on outcomes-based facilitation. So we will talk to the group before they come up here about what it is that they want to accomplish together. And they may not have the solution, probably don't have the solution formed in their mind at that point, but they know what they generally want to work on. So we try to distill an outcome that everyone can find common ground around. And sometimes we have to back up once we get in the room to understand where that starting point is. But starting common ground towards an agreed upon outcome creates a lot of safe space and a good structure for people to have conversations that otherwise tend to go the way a lot of meetings go, which is nothing happens. One person dominates the room. You disagree. Someone leaves. Somebody checks out. You know, we don't want that kind of convening to happen here. So we put a lot of structure around it. And I think those are the kind of some of the key principles. Okay. I would also add, though, that there's a lot of different ways in which people are in conversation together. As you all know, there's a difference between dialogue, debate, and deliberation. You know, dialogue really is meant to uncover, as you all very well know, because Braver Angels offers great tips and tools for how to have a dialogue with someone. But dialogue is really about understanding the other person's point of view and sharing your own so that you better know each other. Debate is something different. You know, in debate, we are actually debating the facts. We're debating multiple sides of an issue. And deliberation, you know, we're trying to make a decision together. And so you have to know what kind of conversation that you want to have in order to have a good one. And there is a place for advocacy. There's a place for protest and all of the things that are other kinds of conversation that are important to community. But what we're really focused on is how can we find common ground and collaborate?
So primarily deliberation would be what you all are focused
primarily
on?
Primarily deliberation at the end. But what I would say is that the dialogue comes first, always. So when we bring a group together at the Institute, you will see us engage in some structured dialogue process for the first couple of hours of that meeting. So typically, a lot of our programs are a noon to noon. So people will stay overnight and they have an opportunity to have a meal together, be in community together, just to get to know each other. But we start with dialogue, and we start with some explicit norms and rules about how to engage in that. Because if you start there, and you start with a safe space for people to share their own experiences, not on behalf of someone else, then what you find is that that mutual understanding grows over the time that they're here. And by day two, they're talking about policy issues or program issues over which they really disagree, but they understand why the other person got to where they are. But that dialogue has to come first.
Yeah, I know we use a lot of ground rules in our workshops as well. In Braver Angels, I'm curious, can you give us a couple of examples of ground rules that might be present for like that dialogue portion?
Yeah, probably one of the most important is that we ask you to speak from your own experience, not on behalf of a group. So we encourage generalization or generalities about us and them. So we want you to talk about your own lived experience. And we also don't want to pressure people to represent a group. You know, often we will have people come here, for example, they may represent the Arkansas Education Association, but that does not mean that that individual has exactly the same viewpoints as their organization. It's very nuanced. So speak on behalf of yourself is number one. We encourage no interruptions. So follow the airtime that we give you, especially in the early part of the convening. We will do timed dialogue where every speaker has, 2 minutes, for example, to speak. And we ask everyone respect that time, but finish speaking when that time has expired. And then we move to the next person and not to interrupt, because that allows everyone to have equal part in the conversation. Those are just a couple.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm curious also, you may or may not be able to answer this question because some of this might be proprietary or client-based that you can't, but examples of work that you have facilitated?
Sure.
Can you hear any?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. So we have a new program that's coming up, which I'll talk about in a little bit, called Civic Arkansas. And that one is just launched this year. But from some examples in the past, one that we've recently included is one that we call IR3. And it is recidivism, reunification, and reentry. This is a program that we've been working on, a collaborative, really, that we've been building for 2 years at the Institute. Of all participants, representatives of all parts of the justice system. So not just corrections and community corrections, but prosecutors, sheriffs, those who were formerly incarcerated, people who are working in service organizations to reunite, coming out of prison with the community. What we really wanted to do was put all of those voices into the room and talk about what they share in common, which is a desire to see our recidivism rates go down so that once someone's released from prison, they don't go back. And so we had a couple of years of building that collaborative to find areas that they shared in common, that they knew if work could be done in this area, they could move the needle. And so they've done some things like raised awareness of incarceration and community corrections and what kind of obstacles are there for those folks and how communities help people reunite successfully within the community, get a job, reunite with their families, become productive members of society. So they've launched a Smart Justice magazine and podcast from that work. There has been some discussion during this collaboration around alternative sentencing and diversionary programs. The group received a $1 million grant from the Attorney General to pilot some of that work. And so that's an example of a lot of different players in a big system who all see justice from a slightly different lens, coming together to say, how can we be stronger together than we are individually and in these silos? You know, we have programs like that, but we also have programs where we bring groups here and try to help them build silos between their own organizations. One that we did a few years ago was with the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences and the University of Arkansas Fayetteville. And these are researchers on both campuses. And your listeners may be thinking right now, well, those people probably don't have political divides. Oh, yes, they do. but really, it's less about political divides as it is just campuses not communicating. They're 3 hours apart. They don't have the time to get to know each other, siloed for a reason, you know. So what we wanted to do was say, what can you do that you can be stronger together? How can you break down some of the obstacles for working together? And we're starting to see some real benefit from actual research collaboration, joint research opportunities from both those entities. So that's just a couple of examples that come to mind. One that I would add that has been particularly interesting is we just did work with the International Society for Third Sector Research. These are researchers who are working in civil society and philanthropy across the globe. And we facilitated a meeting with 22 representatives from 22 different countries. And we just did that in New York at the Pecanico Center of the Rockefeller Brothers Fund. And the intent was to ask how could they support one another in collaboration. And the geopolitical differences in that room were just incredible. I mean, whereas here in America, we might see a small divide, we're worlds apart, literally and metaphorically from each other in some of those ways. So, you know, just being in the midst of those conversations is an absolute joy because every one of us is human. No matter where we're working, what we're doing, we all share our collective humanity and need that connection with each other. So it's a joy to get to do that work.
Those are all great examples. I think Glenn, you want to ask her about something else that you had heard about that they did. So I'll turn it over to you to ask the next question.
You haven't mentioned this yet, but I spoke with some folks in government and politics of just a very few years ago about Braver Angels and what we were doing. And he mentioned something similar that he was involved with, and other politicians, government officials, and other people around the state that happened there at the Rockefeller Institute. It involved all these different community leaders and all trying to find common ground in a civil atmosphere, but I don't know all the details, but it sounds like it could have been just about anything you've worked on. But
might
you know what I'm talking about, a particular one like that?
We have had a number of our programs have had representatives, state representatives or mayors or quorum court members be involved in what we do. That's the things that I'm really pleased about with the Institute and the work that we're doing with the Rockefeller Ethic is that it is just government officials who come here and talk about policy issues. It is people who are working within a system. It's people who are consumers of the services that either government or nonprofit community provide. So most every program will feature some kind of component like that. One of the things that people tend to remember, I think, about the Institute, because this was very high profile, was our work around dicamba. There was back in 2017, the state experienced a lot of conflict and controversy over the herbicide dicamba, which is a herbicide meant to kill pigweed. If you're a farmer in Arkansas, you know what pigweed is, and it's impossible to eradicate. And so dicamba was being used, and in some ways not consistent with the label. There was a lot of crop damage happening. And what we saw in our farming community, which is normally, you know, a pretty close-knit community of folks, is that there was a stark divide between those who used dicamba and those who didn't, and what the policy should be for regulating that. And so the governor appointed a task force of about 18 people who were charged with figuring out how are we going to regulate the use of this product. And one farmer in Mississippi County had been killed in an altercation over this issue. So it was a very, very hot debate at the time. We brought them together here. The Department of Agriculture reached out to us and said, this feels like a different kind of public meeting than we would normally have. And can the Institute facilitate, you know, using the Rockefeller Ethic? And we did. And we started with dialogue, as I said, you know, having those farmers talk with one another about what their responsibility was to their farm, their family, their bottom line, and to each other. And they knew each other. It's not that they'd never connected, but they had been desperately fighting. And so taking that time to be in dialogue first and then talk about what can we share and how can we work together for the collective good. It was a very rewarding experience because we ended up getting to a policy recommendation without having all of the conflict in that moment, in that decision-making. Now, what I will say is that issue still is out there. I mean, there's still controversy and there's still conversation around how to regulate this product. But I do think that it made a difference in how we think about the collective way in which we talk to each other. And so that may be something that you hear about when you talk to people about the Institute.
Yeah, I remember reading about that quite a bit over the last several years. That is a huge issue for Arkansans, particularly those involved in agriculture. So it sounds like you felt like, and you're, like you say, it continues. It's you haven't reached a final resolution yet, but you did see some improvements coming out of that. You think that made a difference?
I think it did. I think the thing to learn from that for all of us is that most of the challenges that we face in a society are not simplistic. They are what we refer to, and a lot of people refer to, as wicked problems. Mm-hmm. Okay, so there's not an easy solution. And I think dicamba is a really good example because this is an example where people weren't really fighting across political divides. I mean, you could say that there may have been more conservative and more progressive views in the room or more liberal views in the room, but really this was about what people decided that they should do together for community and where does individual responsibility end and community begin. And so I think that just having that conversation about this is not an easy issue, I could understand both sides standing up there as facilitator. You want to get rid of this weed because it's impacting your bottom line, and your bottom line is your family farm. But then you've got people who don't want their livelihood to be damaged by a chemical that they can't control. I mean, this is a wicked problem. And so I think these conversations are not one-off. They have to be ongoing. They have to be approached in a spirit of collaboration and wanting to try to understand each other, because we don't ever solve them.
Have you seen the work continue after that? Do you see some results of that, getting people together and discussing those wicked problems and trying to find a way to collaborate?
I do. And, you know, our hope at the Institute is that that's a natural outcome of what we do, that when we bring people together in a room, whether it's around dicamba, we've done issues in rural health and medicine, health equity, education policy, you know, the list goes on. And no matter what the issue is, when you come together and you're a little bit, you know, uncertain about how you're going to voice your opinion, what the other side is going to think, what kind of solution are we going to get to? You know, those are all questions that people have the first time they come into a true, you know, intentional structured collaboration. But when you get to the end of it, our hope that you have develop some of those skills on your own. So the next time that you go out to discuss the wicked problem or a different problem, perhaps, you approach it by thinking, let's be intentional about what our outcomes are. Let's be intentional about getting more voices to the table. Let's structure this. Let's treat each other with dignity and fairness. Let's get curious and ask each other questions. You know, so we want those values to stay with you once you leave the Institute. And we do have workshops designed to help cement that. So beyond just the experience of coming here, we also provide some teaching.
You talk about the skills that they learn, and I would suggest, because I think this underlies a lot of the work we do in Braver Angels, and probably y'all too, that in addition to any skills you pick up, it enhances the development of relationships. And I think relationships are just it's almost like the aspirin of social health, if you will. So I think that probably is an important part of that.
It is a really big part. Yeah, no, absolutely. Thank you for saying that. And Glenn, I know you've been to some of our programs before, so you understand a little bit about how we foster that here. The Institute provides hospitality, so we provide meals, we provide a space for people to play, to be outdoors on campus, to socialize after hours. And we kind of joke that we have you held hostage here, because you're not going to go shopping, you're not going to go to another restaurant, you're on top of a mountain. But what we hear from our program participants so often is the connections that they've made and the friendships that they've built and the people that they never would have imagined that they have become friends with or colleagues with, that now, after having spent some time on the mountain together, they develop a relationship. So thank you for saying that. And that's one of the key tenets. You mentioned walks with the governor earlier. When we talk about Winthrop Rockefeller's leadership legacy, there are five R's that are a part of that. And relationships is a key one of those, because we know that what we can do, what we want to see happen and change in the world, we cannot do alone. And so relationships are at the very foundation of that.
Yeah. And hopefully with the development of relationships and skills, you get to the point where you can appreciate being rivals and not enemies, as you said earlier. That's a really nice distinction to make. That is particularly important, as you know, these days, the way things have gotten in our society, there's just so much polarization. It's gotten to the point where people are turning into enemies, and they used to not do that, but they're doing that now. And so we're needing to turn that back around. So we've had some other Braver Angels alliances in other states work on doing something like what we've done and what you guys have done in getting people in government and out of government, community leaders and just citizens to find ways to understand each other and collaborate. given that you have a long history of doing this kind of work there, I wonder if you might have any suggestions, any recommendations for how, whether it be our group here in Arkansas or some other group that is trying to get government, politicians, community leaders, community organizations together to learn from what you guys have learned works. What can we do to make that happen in Arkansas?
Yeah. Well, I think one of the things, the assets or strengths of Arkansas is our neighborliness and our small size. So these are two things that are actually kind of grounded in data. We just released an Arkansas Civic Health Index report in partnership with the Clinton School of Public Service and Engage Arkansas. And there's some really bad news in that report in that we have a lot of work to do to increase Arkansas civic health in some areas. But the good news is that the fact that we are a small state and that we tend to develop close relationships, we make jokes about 6 degrees of separation. There's not even that in Arkansas communities. You know, everybody knows somebody. And so I think we start there. You know, we start with understanding what we all share in common, trying to ask questions. I mean, the curiosity, and I know Braver Angels talks about this too, and listening and talking with people. Curiosity is so important to what you are asking about, Glenn, because if we don't talk to each other, local elected officials do not talk to citizens in their communities, you know, citizens don't, you know, talk to each other, then we're not having any conversation at all. There's just, we're fighting on social media. We're, you know, so I think you have to start with curiosity. What is it that you want to see change? What is it that you care about and why? So that's where the dialogue comes in. And then just the intentionality, you know, to say we're inviting a conversation about an issue that's important to this community, however we define it. And you know, we want to have everybody at the table, but you have to be intentional and you have to be authentic about that. What I tell people sometimes is if they come to us and you know, there may be a facilitation client prospectively, and they say, well, I want to get a group together because I want them to buy into my idea. Then I say, then you can do that anywhere. You don't need to come here. You can show them a PowerPoint. What I want you to do here is say, what do we all share in common? What is our shared purpose? And then how we move forward together. And I think you can apply those principles anywhere. It doesn't have to be on Petty G Mount. It can be in your local town. It can be in your own organization. So that's where I'd start, curiosity and intentionality.
That's great. I wanted to follow up on a couple of things that you just mentioned. One is we're going to come back and talk about the Civic Arkansas Project, which I want to know more about. But you mentioned the five R's, and I only got one of them. Relationship was, I think, one of them. What are the other four?
Yeah, these are all grounded in Winthrop Rockefeller's leadership values. And so when we do walks with the governor, we take people either for a morning or afternoon session around our campus. They get to sort of see some of the history of Petty G Mountain and Winthrop Rockefeller. And we tell the story of Winthrop Rockefeller and what he learned that informed his own leadership values. And so that's the five R's, which I'll get to. But the thing I want to say about that workshop is that it isn't just about his five values. It's also about your own. So what we do during that walk is we encourage you to think as an individual about how you formed your own leadership values and what your responsibility is to leadership in the world. So five R's that Winthrop Rockefeller talks about that influenced him are responsibility is number one, and that is to the common good. And helping others help themselves, as I kind of mentioned, you know, when we first started this conversation. How do we do that? Do we as leaders enable that in others? Number two is relationships. You know, how do we seek to understand and invite those into our own sphere of influence, whether we're leaders working with employees or leaders working with other leaders, you know, in our community? Respect is number three, which has a lot to do with mutual understanding and spending the time trying to understand the viewpoints of another, why they formed the worldview that they have, what caused it to care. That's that helps to deepen relationships. You can see already these are all intertwined. And then we talk resolve, which is something that Winthrop Rockefeller demonstrated as probably one of his hallmark characteristics. He was determined to solve problems and believed that all problems were solvable and helped to inspire that in us. So we talk about seeing the possibilities. How do we think, you know, innovatively and creatively about problems that we're facing in our communities? And, you know, what are some of the things that may sound like big ideas and big dreams? Like, let's drill into that and see what's possible. And then the last R is reform. And Winthrop Rockefeller was known as a reform governor. He came into the state of Arkansas and made tremendous changes in education, prison reform, economic development, civil rights, you name it, all the while looking at what was existing and questioning how we could make it better. And so that's really what reform means.
Well, thank you all for joining us on today's edition of On the Other Hand. This was the first part of our conversation with Janet Harris from the Winthrop Rockefeller Center. Be sure to check out the second part of this conversation with Janet, as well as other podcast episodes of On the Other Hand. You can find us on the podcast page of the Braver Angels Arkansas website at arkansas.braverangels.org or on many popular podcast sites.
When you visit that website, in addition to the links to all our episodes, you'll find a link to email us at otherhandar@gmail.com, and you can use that to send us with feedback on the program, suggested speakers or topics. One previous interview, if you go on there, that I would suggest you consider checking out is our conversation with Gwen Falconberry last year. Gwen is a teacher and author. She has some interesting stories to tell about her experiences, both when she was running for a position in the Arkansas legislature and another time when she was testifying before the legislators.
On the Other Hand is sponsored by Braver Angels in Arkansas. Music was composed by Randall Standridge of Jonesboro, Arkansas, and was performed by the University of Northern Colorado Symphonic Band. Dr. Richard Main, conductor.
From your host, Glenn White.
And April Chatham Carpenter.
Let's each do our part to bring our community closer together.